Please help me welcome David B. from Laguna Beach as our speaker tonight.
Hi, everybody. My name's David. I'm an alcoholic. So I don't forget, because I spoke last night in some meeting in L.A., and I completely, like, lost all courtesy. Like, I walked in the door, and my sense of a proprietary sense of courtesy was just out the door, and I forgot to thank everybody. I forgot to thank the birthday people. I forgot all this. So welcome to the Chip Takers. Thank you so much for allowing me to see one more time that Alcoholics Anonymous works, and I see it working in your lives, and I know what's coming. I know, because I was, every single one of us in here was there, right? And we all start out with one day and move forward. So we know the magic and the mystery that's coming for you in your life, man, if you stay in this program. Welcome the birthday celebrants. My God, 46 years, where is she? That's just amazing. Happy birthday to everybody. I want to thank my good friend Lee Carroll, my dear friend Lee Carroll, for inviting me. I think like 3 years ago, he booked me to speak at this meeting. It's like, my God, this man is organized. Well, he's CPA, so you know, that comes with that, I guess. It doesn't come for me, right, but it comes for him, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Lee. I have a lot to say, and so I'm glad you guys give a. I had like 20 minutes last night, and that's why I really got in trouble with it, right? That was a long drunkalogue and about 2 minutes of sobriety at the end, right? I squeezed it in, right? And I'm like, yeah, I actually did get sober after all that. So, man, hopefully I won't have that experience tonight. I'm feeling rushed, and I appreciate that, and I thank you guys for listening to me. I really, really, it's a deep gratitude. I get to stand up here and say thank you. That's my job, to say thank you and tell a story that hopefully you can relate to. If not, you can relate to the fact, like, my God, if it worked for this guy, man, it can work for anybody, right? Hopefully you get that, at least, man. So my sobriety date is August 30th, 1997, and I am I'm working on 29 years of sobriety then, right? I can't believe it, right? Because the man I see in the mirror is a completely different version of the man that walked into AA 28 plus years ago. Completely different. Lee saw it. I couldn't talk to anybody my first 2 years sober because I freaking hated all of you, right? Like everyone, even people in the meetings, because I was feeling like I have to get vulnerable. I have to, this armor of ego that I've plated myself with has to be torn down. And I resented that to no end, right? Because then I could be hurt, right? And I knew it was gonna hurt. Sobriety hurts, right? It does. That's my experience. I don't get to run from the pain anymore. I don't get to run from the sorrow. I also don't get to run from the joy, and I don't have to try and find some way to minimize myself or you in this existence that we live. Right? I celebrate it mostly, so I'll put up with the pain, and I'll put up with the sorrows, even when they're, you know. I have lost a lot of good people in my life the last couple of years, right? And the guy that married me and my wife, Tim Whitcomb, passed away. And I don't like this world without Tim in there, right? Just same as I wouldn't like it without Lee in there. You guys have to stay, right? Because I need you. But I know he was in pain, and this is the progression, right? We live, we were born, we live, and we die. You know, I believe that energy is boundless and it's timeless and it moves on, but that's just my own belief. I don't know, right? I don't really know. All right, before I get esoteric, let me give you the particulars. I I was born in Michigan. My parents were going to school at U of M, and we moved to California, to Laguna Beach in 1965. My dad was one of the first professors hired at UCI. He is a mathematical anthropologist. Can somebody stand up and explain what that is, please? Because I can't. I don't really know what my dad does for a living. I don't really, you know, I mean, he's a pure soul, right? He is a pure, you know, they talk about, like I heard talk, I'm not like totally into this, but I've heard talk of auras around you, right? And the scholar's aura is blue, right? It's a blue light aura around you. And that's like one of the highest, like, it's like, that's the one, right, that you want, because it's seeking, it's knowledge, and it's learning. And my dad just fits that to a T, man. He's like a 10-year-old kid but instead of the question, why, it's like, let me tell you why, because he knows, right? I've never heard a subject come up that my dad doesn't have some, like, crazy tidbit of information about it, right? It's like, he is the best person you could, like, as far as a wingman to take to a party to, like, fit in. If you're with my dad, you're in, right? You're in, because he can talk to anybody, and he's so disarming. He's not an intellectual snob of any sort, right? Or slob. He's a really, really good man of sterling character, and I didn't know that for a long time. You know, he was my dad, and he had feet of clay, and as all of us do, and I was a pre-alcoholic little kid, right, with very sensitive emotions, right? You couldn't tell, right? I'd never let on that I was feeling emotion, but the emotions I would feel scared me so much that I would just shut down, and you couldn't get a response out of me for some, you know, wrongdoing I'd done or something. My parents trying to teach me good moral fiber, you know, character and stuff, and all I heard was criticism of me, right? And they kept trying to get through because I was giving them no feedback at all. So it really started to be criticism, and I learned the lesson really, really young that there was something wrong with me from that. It was a completely wrong lesson, and I learned it really well. You know, it was not the message that was intended, and yet I, as a sensitive pre-alcoholic kid, learned that, and then I took over, making sure that that's who I was. I in Laguna Beach, you know, I was good in school. I was, you know, skipped into the seventh grade math class, right, or from the seventh grade into the eighth grade, you know, pre-algebra class, and, you know, was, you know, on the dean's list. I was like, you know, like I'm following right in my family's footsteps. My mom's actually smarter than my dad. She's done a little bit of everything. She's like a Renaissance woman. And my sister's an opera singer. She sang at La Scala in Milan, Italy. She speaks five languages. It's just like, man, my God, man. The whole family is like an intellectual who's who of, you know, what you can do in this world, right? And so I was following right along with it, right? All up into that moment, man, where some kids at school, they got tired of me because I was the school safety. You know what that is, right? It's a little schoolyard narc is what I was, right? And man, I didn't realize that this is not a way to win friends and influence people, right? I mean, I was influencing them, but not in the way I would prefer. You know, I got beat up after school several times over. And finally, they turned me, right? They turned me. They said, hey, come on down after school. We're going to go down below there and smoke a little something, you know, drink a little something. And all I heard was, because I had no friends, I'm the school safety. School safety doesn't have friends. All I heard was people wanting to hang out with me. That's what I heard. I don't know. I didn't know what they were talking about, right? I had no idea. And I don't remember what we did exactly, but I know I ingested something, right? Because I know we were laughing, and it was like uncontrollable laughter, like from deep in my gut. And I hadn't had that experience before of laughing uncontrollably with other people without any excruciating self-consciousness that I normally walked around with. I didn't have any of that. So I'm in, right? I am in. And within months, I went from being Dean's List kid to all I had was I's. I couldn't even get an F. In order to get an F, you got to show up and do horribly, right? I wouldn't show up. I was incomplete throughout all the rest of the time I was in school. I would start something and I'd be gone. I was in every single juvenile county lockup that Orange County has to offer. Several different sentences, right? As a juvenile, I was locked up for most of my juvenile years from ages 13 to 18. And then when I was 18, I went to California Youth Authority. From California Youth Authority, I went to the Oregon Penitentiary. From the Oregon Penitentiary, I went to Soledad. And then I went to Mule Creek Prison. I went to Tehachapi. And then in 1994, I went to visit the federal government at their facility in Salem, Oregon, called FCI Sheridan. I was criminally bent as soon as I put alcohol in my body. What was yours was mine, unless it was nailed down. And even then, I got a pry bar or two, right? If I could get it from you, I would get it from you. I did armed robberies. I did a lot of burglaries. You know what my favorite commercial is? The Mayhem Man, right? I have that on my record, right? I am actually been charged with mayhem before. You know, it's not like it's really not something to be proud of. It's a funny commercial. I like it, right? The whole idea of it all, but mayhem is not something that you sleep good at night after having committed, right? It's one of the things that haunts me. You know, the things I've done to other people through my. I don't want to say criminal career, because I'm not a criminal standing before you now. It's not who I was then. It was just what was in me. I had to express it some way, because I couldn't feel the pain. I didn't know how to deal with the anguish. I didn't know how to deal with the sorrows of what I thought life had handed me. And I really didn't know how to deal with the shame of what I had done. Right, that was the real thing that was burying me, all the secrets that I've done in 24 years of active drinking and using. It was killing me. So I got tired. Like I said, I got tired of all those state penitentiaries I was in, and I was happened to be at a rehab called the Rock Center in Orange County, and in the Rock Center. You know how water always seeks its own level, right? So me and two other ex-convicts became best of friends after a week, right? And one of them was a gentleman named Phil, the Sicilian guy from I think he's from New York originally. But he was known as the gentleman bandit of Orange County and LA County during the 80s, and he robbed like 63 banks. Man, that dude was prolific, right? He got 6 years, right? You rob 63 banks and you do 6 years in prison. I'm like, man, sign me up, man. That's not bad at all. I could do 6 years, right? I've already done 6 years, right? So when the wheels fell off again out of that rehab, because I'm still the same guy, right? So this old drunken horse thief, you know. I'm not drunk anymore, but I'm still a horse thief. And my behavior ended up putting me in a place to where the natural progression of me as an alcoholic is I'm going to drink again. The same man will drink again, and the same man did drink again. And I ended up burning all my bridges. This is how I burn bridges. First, you have to have an accelerant, right? And I'm the best accelerant I know for burning shit to the ground. Excuse my language, but that I burned it, man. I burned everything around everybody and everyone. And I knew there was a axiom about writing, right? I'd taken some short story classes, right, from Berkeley while I was locked up, and I'm like, and they always said, write about what you know, right? So I'm like, well, if I'm gonna rob a bank, I'll rob a bank that I know, right? So I robbed my dad's bank in Laguna Beach, right? Well, all the tellers know me, right? And I walked in, you know, with the disguise, and they go, "Hey, Dave," and I'm like, Oh, I'm already committed, right? I'm already committed. And I ended up robbing 7 banks after that, right? And not near as prolific as Phil. And it lasted 3 months, right? And I got rescued by the local police in Bend, Oregon, and they gave me 151 months. And I did the math. You know, I skipped ahead in math class. I did the math quickly. And I'm like, that's almost 13 years. Like, did you notice that was unarmed bank robbery, sir? Right? I tried to talk the judge off of it, and his hands were tied. It was a matrix system of sentencing, and that's what they had to give me, right? He did go on record saying that he doesn't even know why he's here as a judge if there's a matrix system for sentencing, right? But, you know, that didn't help me at that moment. So 12 years, 7 months I was sentenced to. And like I said, I went to Sheridan. And while I was in Sheridan, I found out I didn't have to stop, right? So now, clear picture, I'm 33 years old and I'm a 5-time loser already. And I'm just starting a 12-year, 7-month term. And, all right, and I'm going to be 45 years old when I get out of this, if I have good behavior, which is a big if. You would think, like, this is a moment, right? Like, hold on. The trajectory of your life is not looking like it's going to be, it's not good. I'm not going to be on TV like Snoop Dogg with Martha Stewart anytime soon, right? It's not happening for me. But I don't know any other way of life. I my answer to everything that didn't feel good in me was medicated, right? So I did the best I could to stay as high as I possibly could on drinking the Pruno or cooking off the Pruno into White Lightning or any of the strong sedatives that were on the yard, anything to stop being in me in this moment, because that's a painful place to be, right? It was just like, this is a horror show. This is what my life is. That was like my mantra when I first walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was, the horror, right? From Apocalypse Now. Like, that was it, man. When he said those words, I was like, that's me, that's my life, right? And so I was in Sheridan for a couple years, and then something hit the yard, and my chain was already, like, there was no more room on it. I couldn't borrow any more money. I couldn't do it, but stuff was on the yard that I wanted to be a part of. So I went and burglarized the commissary. So I got to keep the stream rolling, and that didn't go so well. Remember I told you about being in school safety and taking notes on people and stuff, you know, they're smoking behind the bathrooms or whatever. There was 11 notes on the lieutenant's desk saying, David did it, right? God, really? That's karma's hard to escape for me. There was another moment there, because they put me in the hole for a year, and so I'm, you know, like I said, I'm in this position in my life. I'm a 5-time loser. I got absolutely nothing, right? I've got an abandoned ex-wife on the streets. I've got probably a total of 2 years. You know, I'm 33 years old. I probably have a total of 2 years of actually living on the streets. I'm very incarcerated. I mean, I'm very institutionalized at this point. Like, really. Like, I know I don't look it now, but I have a picture on my phone if you want to see it after the meeting. I found this picture of me at Lompoc, July of 97, a month before I got sober. It doesn't look like who's looking at you right now. It really doesn't. I had a shaved head. I had a Fu Manchu mustache, and I wouldn't wear my glasses because you don't look tough. You just can't look tough with glasses on, right? So I'd be out on the yard, and I'm all bulked up from lifting weights and stuff, right? And I'd be out on the yard, and I'd see somebody across the yard, and I would squint to see him, right? Like, more than once, I had dudes drive up on me, like, ready to fight, saying, man, you were mad-dogging me on the yard, bro. I saw you, man. And I'm like, no, I'm really, I can't see. I was trying to see who it was. So it was image is everything in there. So I had a moment where it seemed I got thrown in the hole for burglarizing the commissary, and then while I was in the hole, I fought the cops that were trying to move my cell. They were trying to move me to another cell. And I had a batch of Pruno made, and I wasn't ready, right? It wasn't ready. I couldn't drink it yet. So I said, no, I'm not moving, right? And they smiled at that, right? They loved that, right? And they said, oh, okay, we'll be back. And they came back, five deep, five of the biggest corn-fed, huskiest white boys you've ever seen, and you know, from the fields of Oregon, so you know, lumberjacks, right? and they come in the cell, and they're like, team up, and they just bust in one after another, pushing like that, one after another. So there's like, if you're trying to hold them back, you're holding back five dudes, five large dudes, and you know, they look like Ninja Turtles. You can't, they're all carapaced and armor, and you know, they can't get this, like, it's not really people, right, coming at you, right? It's like aliens or something, or coming in my cell. So I did what, you know, what I know how to do best is I crawled underneath the bunk that had a built-in, welded-in shelf underneath it, and there was a hole about that big that if you're really, really like a contortionist, you could fit behind there and wedge yourself in. And I said, I told you I'm not moving. Right. Well, they tried for about 15 minutes. Well, it seemed like 15 minutes. It was probably 30 seconds. They tried to get me out from underneath there, and they're trying to grab me, and I'm ripping their gloves off, and then they don't want to reach back in case I want a Hannibal Lecter on them or something, right? So there's a camera on you the whole time while they're doing this, right? They record the whole thing for, you know, legal purposes and stuff. Well, when the camera disappears, it's time to give up. So, because I knew the pain was coming, right? Broomsticks and, you know, stuff that you can do when you're not on camera, right? They'll do to you to get you out of there. So I gave up, and they trussed me up like a Thanksgiving turkey and rode me up and down the cells, right, to show them all what was going on. Because while this cell extraction was happening, I forgot to tell you, I was screaming like a little boy, right? Just screaming my lungs out, right? I don't know why. It just seemed like a thing to do. And the rest of the place thought that the cops were murdering me, right? They thought they were killing me, right? So they're going, all the cells in the hole were going off. And this was at FCI Sheridan. They, two dudes lit their mattresses on fire, right? Probably not really well advised. You're in a 6x8 cell and you're going to light your mattress on fire, right? So they had to go rescue those guys. But it felt like man, like we're having a moment, right? Like Rage Against the Machine, right? Man, it didn't feel like that, man. It didn't feel like that when I, you know, when they trussed me in the hole again and left me tied up in there for a while. You know, it's like, this is the culmination of my life to this point. This is what 33 years of running on Dave will get you, right? Just, like, four-pointed and not able to move a muscle, right? Wondering if I should call again for the bedpan. Like, that's not a lot of options in my life at that moment. So still didn't get through. They sent me to USB Lompo Penitentiary. And in Lompo Penitentiary, I quickly got started right where I'd left off, and I was in the hole again, right? Like within 30 days of getting there, I was in the hole again. And I spent 90 days in the hole there, and when I got out, they put me in with a dude that had more prison game than anybody I'd ever met. Like this dude, like we were drunk or high every single day for 3 months because of this dude's hustle, man. He had hustle. He didn't have money, he had hustle. And the last thing I was doing, what I was doing while I was in this picture that I have in my phone, you could send money out to the streets, right? To any address. Any name, any address. If you had money on your accounts, you could send it out to the streets. So that's how people would purchase their illicit, you know, goods and stuff in there. And now, I'm a pretty good artist, right? So I got this little thing of plastic, and I carefully carved out the exact United States seal and date, right, for that they stamped these send-out forms with. And I mixed up my pigments, and I got the exact shade of red, and I went, boy, that'll pass, right? We sign, the lieutenant's name, and we sign the counselor's name, and then we'd go show dudes. Look, we sent the money. Give us our stuff, right? And they would, all right, and they give us our stuff. And we did that to a lot of people in there. We did that like 5 or 6 times to very, we didn't care who it was. We were not prejudiced. We'd burn anybody. It was not behavior that's conducive long-term life in prison, right? You don't want, man, I can't believe I didn't get stabbed. I really can't believe it. In the course of this, there's a dude that was selling drugs on the yard. His name was 6'8". 6'8" was a description of his size, and that was an absolute, like, he was bigger than 6'8", right? That was the biggest human being I've ever seen in my life, right? He was 300 pounds, just giant. I don't know if you remember him, Lee. He was a big man. And he came by my cell, and he goes, "Here, when can you pay me?" And I said, 2 weeks. And I took what he gave me. And I had no idea how I was going to pay that guy in 2 weeks. But all I heard was, "Do you want to get out of Dave?" I'm like, "Yes." You know, and I would say anything at that point, right? So I took what he gave me, and it wasn't what he had promised. And I sat up all night with my teeth clenched, my body trembling, going, "This is insanity. This is insanity. This is not something you want to be doing in prison when you can't get out of your cell and you can't move, right? You can't. It's just raw Dave at that moment, right? Like this is not an escape. This is like it's like magnifying the position I was in life, right? So I woke up that next morning with the best thing that I've ever had. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I was absolutely destroyed. And I had been in AA. I'd been in AA several times up to this point, right? I'd never done the steps. I'd never had a sponsor. And so I was like, you know, I was a guest in AA several times before this. Once I'd been stabbed in the eye in a bar fight. And in order to have a place to live, they told me that, my parents told me that you have to attend Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm attending meetings in 1984 in Laguna Beach with Chuck C., Joe Q., Joe Quinn, Dr. Paul. That all, there was a John A, B, and C, right? It was like, there's all these giants of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm in the meetings with them, and I didn't hear a thing. Like, I didn't hear a thing. See, because I still had one good eye and multiple bright ideas left, right? There was no way I was going to be able to hear anything because this voice was way too loud. You know, I read a book called, I'm going to go off on a tangent. Hopefully I can get back. I read a book called Not God. This guy did his thesis on Alcoholics Anonymous. This was an unofficial, it wasn't conference approved, but we did open our, you know, all our archives to him, right? And so his thesis in the title of his book, Not God, is the story of what happens to us, very simplified, when we walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. We become not God. Because we are God when we walk in here. With the ego that we have, or you know, the reverse of it, the shame, right? It's like, I am playing God in this world every time I pick up a drink and try to enforce my will everywhere I go, right? Even if it's just like, hey, I'm not hurting anybody. I'm just sitting here in my little hovel and content with my lot in life. I'm not doing what God brought me here to do. God brought me here to give. He brought me here to share. He brought me here to experience with my people, right? The very thing I'm so scared of, people, other people. I was not prepared to be not God for a long time. I was 37 years old when I hit that wall of demoralization, and I immediately went search. I knew where the answer was, and I went looking for Alcoholics Anonymous on a level 4 prison yard. Didn't really think it, with not a lot of hope, you know. But I had no other hope, you know, because I was done with me. I was absolutely. I've heard that old thing about it's just like driving around in your car and all the things that you do, you just keep throwing them in the back seat. And then when you stop driving that friggin' car that's so out of control, everything that's in the back seat just inundates you, just covers you. when you stop, and it just crashed all over me. And I found a couple guys in the unit that I knew there's something different about them, because their lockers were full, right? They weren't giving all their stuff to the pruno guy or the dope guy or whatever. They had stuff, right? And they seemed to be very, you know, they weren't mixing with the bad crowds. They weren't in the gambling tables. They weren't doing much of anything, except I knew they went somewhere on a Monday night, Monday afternoon. I can't remember what the exact days of the meetings, but I knew they went somewhere, some group or something, right? So I wonder if it's AA. So I went and asked these guys. I said, "Hey, man, is there any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous?" I spoke really quietly, right, because I didn't want to ruin my image in there, right? I'm a bank robber, and I burglarized the commissary, right? That was my coat of arms, right? Carried it around with me. God. And these guys immediately perked up, and they're like, "Bro, you wouldn't believe," and their voices started raising. They got that big AA smile, like, we got a newbie, right? And I'm like, "Shh, come on, you know I burglarized the commissary in Sheridan, right?" And I'm like, and I walked into the next day. I'm trying to remember if you were there or not, Lee. I don't remember. It was in the. You might not have been. I think it was a meeting that they had in the pastor's offices in there or something. But this is what I finally heard. I finally, in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, heard something. I heard a group of men talking about becoming people of dignity and honor. And these are convicts like me, right? These are people that, man, they've been gaveled away from the light of day and all society by the judge. And I'm just like them. And they're doing something different. They're sponsoring each other. They're working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous on a level 4 yard. You're going to do a fifth step on a level 4 yard, you're going to tell somebody all the things that keep you apart from the light of God and your fellow man. And that if it gets out on the yard, will absolutely destroy you and someone will come for you. Or you'll have to check in or something, you know, go to protective custody. I'm not doing that, right? I'm not doing that, man. Unless, and this is what I realized finally, unless all these secrets that I have, unless rather than me taking them to the grave with me, it's the other way around. They were taking me to the grave with them. That's who I was, man. That was the walls that I built up around myself of secrets, right? All the shame and all the things I'd done. Really quick, another quick tangent. This was one I blocked out of my memory until my mom mentioned it like 5 years later. For 5 years, I blocked this out of my memory. My grandmother lived in Oregon. I went to visit her on my 18th birthday. She didn't have much for me. I'm trying to get well. I'm trying to get my high on. So she sent me to her neighbor's house who wanted to meet, you know, my Nina's grandson, right? So she sent me over to this woman's house. This woman is probably 90 years old. She's completely blind. She fed me milk and cookies. I said, "Can I use your restroom?" She said, "Sure." I walked past her restroom into her bedroom, took the jewelry box, all her mementos from her passed on husband, from her dead, from she was a widow, put it under my arm and walked out the door, shook her hand, said, "I gotta go, ma'am. Thank you very much." With that underneath my arm, right in front of her. I locked that. I blocked it completely from memory. You know, my mom mentioned it 5 years later. I was like, "What are you talking about?" I would have, and it came flooding through. I don't even know, at 28 plus years sober, I don't even know to this day how much those things still affect me. All that shame, all those horrible things that I did to people. That was just the tip of the iceberg of stuff I did. I can't imagine being that man now. Right, I'd have tackled that man and held him for the pole. I'd have been the school safety one more time for that. If I had ran across that, right? That's who I am now. But I still carry that. Right? I still carry those things and the physical things I did to other people. You know, I used to tell that story from the podium until somebody walked up to me afterwards, I respect, and said, "Never tell that story from a podium again." So I'm like, okay, we share in a general way, right? So this is the meetings, though, that I walked into. people on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, man. Lee was the first in line, right? He wore two hats like nobody I've ever saw, a correctional officer and an absolute gem of a man leading a few committed inmates into a whole new way of life. That's what he did for us, right? I talked about sharing in a general way. I don't know if you remember this or not, but you used to not share in a general way. You used to attend meetings with us and share with us. He's not supposed to do that as a correctional officer, right? But he led the way by that truth, man, by the example you set. We followed right after you. It's kind of funny with the 7 years I spent as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous in a level 4 prison are like it feels like the golden age of my life. You know, I used to walk that track crying tears of joy with my brothers, right? Either my sponsors or my friends or my sponsees, and just amazed at that God has come in and now lives within my life no matter where I am. No matter. There's no walls that can keep him out, right? In my experience, God of my understanding, there is nothing that can keep him out. If I truly seek him, he will be there. And he was there. I walked through some horrible stuff in there. I had two guys that I was trying to work. I was working at the electronic cable factory in there. We built parts for the United States missiles, right, and all kinds of other stuff. Military gear, right? Anything electronic, we built it in that place. And I was ahead of the box crew. We built these electrical supply boxes, right? And I had a couple guys on our crew, right? There's about 20 guys or so. I had a couple guys I was working on. They were good prospects for AA, and I liked them, right? And by this time, I'm 3 or 4 years sober, and I'm like sending a bit of example. On the yard, they knew me as the knucklehead that burglarized commissary, and that's a compliment. If you're a knucklehead in prison, you're a good dude, right? That's like a badge of honor, right? So I'm trying to carry the message to these guys, right? They're in the middle of it, man. They're in the middle of it. And they got word from some AB, Aryan Brotherhood dude in the hole that this other dude that was in AA and that we were working with, even though he wasn't sober yet, needed to be taken out. So one day I came back from lunch and the two guys I were working on, I noticed that they were really out of it. Like they were, I don't know what they were on, but they were on something like seriously loaded, like couldn't hardly stand up in the hallways. When we got to the tool line where everybody checks out tools, they checked out a hammer and a very long screwdriver. And one of them grabbed the roll of the wire and they threw it over the third guy's shoulders, so the wire kind of encased him. He couldn't fight back, and they murdered him right in front of me. I wasn't as close to me to Angel right there in the blue shirt. I'm looking right down the aisle at this happening. I know all three of those guys, and I found the first time that I'm no longer separated from all of you. In years past, I've seen stuff like that. Better him than me, and walk away. I watched this, and part of me was dying with that guy. I couldn't stand it. I screamed and grabbed this big rack of material and tried to pull it over. It was too heavy. I couldn't do it, right? But because I was screaming like that, when the cops came running, they came and they gaffled me up, right? They rolled me up thinking that, you know, one of the officers said Boyd was seen running from the scene. Boyd was observed running from the scene. Right? No, I wasn't running. I was just destroyed. That's all. You know, I couldn't stand it. And I found that I'm no longer separated. And your sorrow is going to be my sorrow, right? Your loss. Horrible things that happen, I have to be, if I'm going to be a part of the good, I have to be a part of the bad, and I have to feel it all. Otherwise, it's going to start damming up inside me again, and I'm going to be hard again. I'm going to be a callous human being that doesn't care about other people. I'm going to go back to that guy. I had some good lessons in there, really good ones. I was working on this giant machine, And I'm hitting this button. It's a thermal press. It compresses rubber, heats rubber, and compresses it down into these molds. Giant machine. It's about the size of a car, right, and taller. And I'm hitting these buttons. I'm running around. I was an electronic maintenance man after a while, right? I got good at electrical stuff. And I'm hitting this, and then I hit this other button, and a solenoid engaged over on the other side. So I go running around the other side, and I come up off the ground. I'm like,
what?
And my scalp is peeled back. I got blood running down my face, and I looked up, and there's a little piece of my scalp on a sign that said danger. I hit the danger sign and almost knocked myself out, right? And I started laughing maniacally, right? Like, I could immediately saw it. I don't see the danger signs in life. I don't see them, man. I need other people hey, don't go down that road, Dave, right? It's gonna hurt, right? I need you. I need you for that. How can I see the problems in my life? I am the problem in my life, right? How can I see myself at that degree? I need help. I don't know about you, but I need help. So I was, I'm going to tell this story, even though I know I'm stretching here. Hold on. No, I'm not going to tell this story. So I was there 7 years. I paroled once again. I was age 44 years old. I paroled to nothing. I've got a strange ex-wife, long ex, and you know I have a son who's 18 years old, and I've never talked to him. I never met him. I met him one time when I was sober in prison. My parents brought him up, and it was just weird, right? It was just strange, right? You know, the only thing I remember we talked about is he was looking at his grandpa's hands and my hands and his hands, and he's like, "Well, you can see who the young one is," and I was like, "I got old hands." You know, it's like, that's all I remember. You know, it's not much to begin a relationship on. So this time I was, I knew I had to do what you had done. I knew I had to do what the H&I members in Lompoc had taught me. You know, guys like Curtis Larkin and Patrick Guthrie and of course Lee. And there's a host of people. There was one that was in, that I still remember from AA. I was in AA briefly in Tehachapi, and there was this old gal named Angie, right? She was a Hispanic woman about yay high, and she was, I remember seeing her when I got out at a convention. She was 95 years old, out on the dance floor, cutting it up, man. I'm like, that's sobriety right there. That's what I want, right? That's what I want to see, right? I want to see people embracing and living life to the fullest, because that's something I've never done that. So people like that, it was like, I know what I need to do. I need to be a member of H&I. So those were the three phone numbers I had when I got out. Three people that were heavily involved in Orange County H&I. So I was in there from the gate, right? Like I'm on federal probation and severely restricted as far as my movements. And I just kept pressing and pressing. I said, I need to go to this H&I meeting. I need to go to the Garden Grove Lano Club on this date. I need to go. I need to go. And I just pressed them, and they let me go. And I started my journey as a member of H, a free man and a member of H&I. It was the greatest ride ever. There's nothing like walking, dressed just like this, because that's what I would do. I'd dress up just like this and walking into a prison where I used to be an inmate at. Right, walking into Chino Prison, where I'd been in many times, and having the officers call me sir, open the doors for me. Would you like me? No, that's fine. I'm good. Right. But I did jump a little when those big bar doors clanged shut behind me. Right. I'm like, oh God. The first time I went in, it was in Chino East Yard. Chino East Yard at that time was a violator's yard. So it's all guys like me, right? Like multiple offenders, right? In there for violations and stuff, right? And I walked, I just floated in there. My dress shoes felt like Air Jordans, man. I was just floating down the aisle. They're like, oh my, this is really happening. This was the most powerful experience of my life at that point, walking into the place where I had spent some really not fun time, right? And as we're in the vestibule where all the guards are and waiting for the escort or whatever to the chaplain's area, right? This one lieutenant starts fucking mad dogging. He started mad dogging me, man. He was like looking at me and looking at me. And I'm like, oh no, he knows. I'm like, wait a minute, he doesn't know anything. He's seeing a dude in a suit, right? But sure enough, he comes over to talk to me and he goes, listen, sir, I this is your first time in here, isn't it? And I said, yeah, and I'm waiting for him to say, have you been here before? I think I know you. But he didn't. He said, I just want you to know, don't expect anything from these guys in here. They're just here for the coffee. They're not here to listen to a man like you. Like, he held me in esteem, right? Just because of the way I looked. Or maybe is that I a bit of a sacrifice of my life to drive however far I drove to go through all the rigmarole of getting into a level 3 prison and talking to the inmates there. He had to have seen something in me, right? And I started to explain to him, right? And I'm like, no, that's probably not a good idea. Right? I explained to him right where I'm from and how this is such a magical experience for me. I probably shouldn't explain this. So I just told him the truth, right? I said, well, sir, I'm here for me, right? He goes, didn't really get it, but he accepted that. And then I walked in to where all these inmates were, right? And these dudes looked at me like, what is this fool in a suit going to tell us, right? What is he going to, he's got nothing for us, right? And then I started talking their language. And I saw a physical change come over them from smoking and joking in the back to nudging each other, leaning in, right? Like,
all I've ever gone through in life, all the horrible things I've ever done were the best things I had in my toolkit at that time. For a moment there, I didn't regret a bit of it because it allowed me to touch the heart of another man. I could open up a little avenue where I could shine some of the light that people like Lee had shown on me to them. There's nothing more powerful in the world than helping another human being. There's nothing. And I could see it in my life, the very, very few times where I had done something for fun or for free for somebody else. I remember those times. I remember that. It wasn't intentional. It was accidental. Right? I wasn't on that footing that we are in AA, right? To look for opportunities to be of service, to look for people to help, you know, but it was still powerful because that is what we're here for. It's what I am here for. You know, that great mystery of like, why are we here, right? Why are we here? Not here to break minds off. I'm here to break it off for you. Now, I think if I can incorporate that into everything I do, I try to. You know, I'm an electrical contractor. Laguna Beach Electric is my company, and me and my wife's company. I try to treat my work as that, as being of service. Right, and I don't rest until my customers are happy. I've never had a bad review, right? Never, right? I have no reports on my license to California State License Board, right? I don't have a single bad review on Google. Right? Actually, I have a 1 4-star review that I'm really kind of like, why did you even give the review then? She gave us a 4-star review, and then she said, David was absolutely perfect. He did everything right, and I am so happy, and I would recommend him to anybody. That sounds like a 5-star review to me, man. I don't know. Like, what? And then I talked to my mom. She's like, oh, I never give 5-star reviews. Why would I do that? No one's perfect. Everybody falls a little short, right? I'm like, Mom, are you like, got a little God in you, don't you? I'll tell you what the toughest thing for me was when I got out. Now, you got to remember, I've done, not counting juvenile time, as an adult, I've done 24 years in state and federal penitentiaries, right? And I'm 44. Right? That's a lot of time not around women, right? Like, a lot. I had no ability to talk to women, like none. I was terrified of women. I didn't go, like, there was no rolls in the hay when I got out of prison, right? I was too terrified to even look at a woman, right? And so pretty soon, and there they are here, I'm going to tell you, there are predatory women in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And pretty soon, one of them, you know, made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I was like, oh, well, this is it then. And I was with her for the next 7 years, right? Still with the blinders on, still terrified to talk to other women, right? I got a girlfriend. I don't have to talk to you, right? And that kind of ended, right? She kind of ended that, right? And now I'm kind of unleashed in the world of AA and dating. The other thing I learned to do was downhill mountain biking. I broke my foot. I broke 7 ribs on one side. I broke my back, L3 vertebrae, into 3 different pieces, right? I had my back rebuilt, right? Broke a bunch of things. I can't even list it all. Right? I'll take that damage any day over the damage that I accrued in both myself and the women that I chose to date for those 5 years after me and that girl broke up, right? After my 7-year get-well girlfriend after we broke up. It finally, my sponsor, whose name is Otis Johnson. Otis put me on dating restrictions. Right? I'm 55 years old. At that time I was 16 years sober, 17 years sober, something like that. And I'm like, bro, really? I'm like, where is that in the fine print, right? And I don't see that in the black print, right? What literature is that from, right? And he said, what damn sponsors always say, well, let's check the record. Oh my God, man. Okay, all right. And I did, right? I ceased and desisted dating. I flirted a little bit, but no dating, right? I'd go on group stuff, like group hikes and stuff like that. I wouldn't go, hey, let's me and you take a hike somewhere. Right? I wouldn't, you know, I didn't do it. And then I was at a convention in Ventura, and this woman, this older Irish woman, she walked up and she loves me, right? She loves the story of, like, criminality combined with frothy emotional appeal that I give when I talk, right? So she said, now who are you dating? She's all into my business, right? And I started playing her my little sob story, right? And I'm like, oh, my sponsor is good. She goes, no, stop. I don't want to hear that, right? She was like 4 years sober at the time, right? She said, I don't want to hear that. That's because you've been dating the women that would have you rather than the one that you want. Now, who is it? And she has got to be an Al-Anon, right? She must be, man. That was quick cutting to the heart of me. And before I even knew it, I said, Sarah, it's Sarah. I had no idea. I was not fiending on Sarah in any way, shape, or form. She was so high above me in the echelon of, like, looks, education. She had almost as much time as I did, right? She was like an untouchable woman, right? And I couldn't imagine she'd be single anyway. She wasn't dating someone. I didn't see a wedding ring on her. But you know, she's like, not for me. She's not for me. Well, this woman, Carol, started hopping from foot to foot because she knew something about Sarah that I didn't. She was quite close to Sarah. And she knew that Sarah had been casually dating people for like 10 years. And before the coffee was served over the dinner, she knew that the dude was going to be on friend status. She had extremely high, she was very picky, right? She's very, very picky. And so Carol, over the course of the next 3 months, I had to wait for my year to be up, right? Over the next 3 months, Carol just, like, hammered me to give Sarah a call, right? And I finally did. I asked her for coffee, and instead I took her to Sinopolis Cinema, where the fold back seats and stuff, right, in the center section that you could pull up and snuggle in with and all that, right? And I didn't do any of that. I was an absolute gentleman, right? Like, absolute. But I also let her know that, look, I'm not asking you because I you know, this is like, I want to begin a friendship with you, and you know, and all that, unless that's the, what you want. But I am quite interested in you, and I would love to see where we could go, because you just shine for me, right? You just shine. And she was, you know, I had some overshare, right? But she overlooked it and just said, well, thanks for your honesty, right? And the key was in the, and I let 2 days go by, seemed right, right? I let 2 days go by, and I gave her another call and asked her out again. Now, this is the test, right? And she said yes. And I was like, oh, my. I'll show you a picture of her, too, after the meeting if you want. Sarah is quite, I mean, she is the most beautiful woman I know and I've ever seen. She used to be a model, right? She was a model in New York and a model in Europe, right? Touring Europe in a modeling group, and she's damn near as tall as me, right? It's like we're, and she's always been waiting for. She's never lived with a man. She's never been married. Never lived with a guy, and she kept looking around in AA, going and seeing all these happy stories of couples, you know, like boy meets girl in AA campus and marries and they're happy and they got kids and family. And she's looking around going, where's mine? Where's mine? And all her friends kept telling her, he's coming. He's coming. He just hasn't paroled yet. That was the other thing about Sarah. She grew up in Huntington Beach, right? In the height of the punk rock deal, right? And she's seen it all, right? She's seen the ex-cons, she's seen the drug addicts, and she's seen how people operate in AA as well, which is not always with high moral character. And she's like, I'm never going to date an AA, and I'm never going to date an ex-convict. I promise you that, right? And she got both, right? She got both of us. A year and a half later, I asked her to marry me. A year after that, she moved in with me, right? We really took our time. We didn't jump in bed together. We didn't jump in bed for months and months. It seemed like decades, right? But but we did old school courtship, right? We built it well, right? And we've been in a God-led relationship ever since, right? We got married in 2018, and she's 100% Irish, like 100%, right? When she was living in New York, she had a couple black friends or black girlfriends, and one of the other friends of theirs was like, what are you doing, you know, at some party or something, what are you doing with that? Sarah was the only white girl there, right? She said, what are you doing bringing that white girl? And her friends told her, you lay off her. She's not white. She's Irish. And she is a force of nature, right? I've married a force of nature, and I'm not scared of it, right? I'm not afraid of it, right? I like the idea that I'm with a partner there, right? So she took me, all her family is in Ireland, right? She took me to Ireland. They had, in Limerick, Ireland, I spoke at their big Saturday night speaker meeting, right? They found out about me earlier in the week, and they say, hey, boyo, you should be the speaker for the, right? And I'm like, all right, are you sure you want to hear this, right? So I told them my good old-fashioned American bank robbery story, right? And they just loved it. They ate it up. I didn't tell all Sutter's relatives. I didn't feel like, well, let's just let bygones be bygones and accept me for who I am right now, because that's a man I really am. I went, after that, we went to Rome. Now, I know more about Roman history, right, than I do about American history. I love Roman history. It's just, there's something about it. Just all those years of reading in prison, it's like, man, I love that stuff. And I just read and read and read, like all the Colleen McCulloch and all the people that wrote Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. I read all that, man. So we go to Rome for 4 days. Right, and one of those days, which was amazing. You walk around a corner, and there's something 2,500 years old. right? 2,500 years that's been there, right? It's just, they talk about the new cross that they put on the certain building, right? Well, the new cross was put on there in 1817, right? It's like, there's nothing that old in Laguna Beach, right? There's nothing there. But we went to the Vatican Museum, right? And I told you I'm an artist, right? So I had a great appreciation for all the stuff I saw in there. I did not know there was such a... And this is supposedly like the fifth best collection in the world, with the Louvre being number one, right? It was room after room of the most amazing things I've ever seen created by humans, right? Like, it just gives me hope, right? In spite of what goes on in the world, I see the good, right? And I know that's as much a part as the bad. And I'm hoping it edges a little more. But anyway, our director for the tour, right? A little private tour through the Vatican Museum. It was so cool. He was a trained... he was going to school. He was a trained dramatic actor, and he was going to school for the art stuff. So he had knowledge and presentation, and he gave a great tour. And at the end of it, we end up in the Sistine Chapel. I looked up at that, and everything I'd just seen for the previous hour and a half, and all of it, I just started sobbing tears of joy at the magnificence of what I was seeing, right? And what I was experiencing. And the surreality of where I was compared to all those years in a 6x8 cell. And now I'm standing underneath the Sistine Chapel. I'm looking at Adam reaching his hand towards God, and God ready for him, right? Just as he was with me, just as he is with all of us that truly seek in this program. I just broke down. Like, once again, here's women with children shying their children away from the guy having a nervous breakdown right there in place. And the director, right, this guy that gave us the tour, he just smiled and, you know, folded his arms and leaned back against the wall. He's like, yeah, my job is done. I am so grateful. I'm so eternally grateful. I got to tell you, I am not... finished product of alcohol. Like, I am not anywhere close to it. All the stuff you've heard, right? I'm a mix of all that, right? I have good days, I have bad days. I have had things I've experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous, things that I have done sober. I got it the excuse of I was drinking or I was drugged, right? I don't have the excuse. I did bad things as a man in this world, sober, just stone cold. So I didn't rob anybody or hurt anybody, but I did things that I am not proud of. I am ashamed of, and I have had to go to another program to address, right? As is outlined in the book, we seek outside help, and I had to seek outside help. It has been a huge, huge growing experience. And at 18 years sober, when it first started happening, I couldn't believe that this was... I had compartmentalized myself so well. I was, you know, Mr. H and I, Mr., you know, he's a regular, he's a good dude, he's a speaker sometimes, right? I had all these things in place that I could have this little secret. One more time, it's the secrets that kill me. I had this little secret off to the side, and it was destroying me. It was slowly taking me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was feeling more and more disconnected, no matter the work I was still putting in. The secrets are an insulator. They insulate us from the juice. It's like, I'm an electrician, right? When they say in the book, like, nobody would do without electricity in their life, right? But who really knows how it works? I know how it works, right? I do. If there's insulation, there's no juice flowing. I can't get what I get from you, and I can't get the light in my life if I'm insulated from it. And the secrets are the best insulator that I know, closely followed by anger, you know, and all the rest of the seven deadlies, right? It's like these are insulators. They stop us from connecting with each other. Right, so I've done major work over the last 6-7 years of getting rid of some of these insulators that were still in place after 17 years sober, 16, whatever it was, 16, 17 years sober. I am probably going to I'm going to be perfect one day. When I'm dead, I'll be perfectly dead. Until then, it's you know, I'm seeking the light. I'm seeking you. I'm seeking the light in you, because that's where I see God most. It's in the lives of others. On the ride up here, I listened to Sandy Beach, like one of his last talks, and I listened to Clint Hodges. Right. And it's like I'm driving up here listening to these guys crying my eyes out with joy because of the way they express what's in my heart, right? The way they express the things that I've learned, right? I've learned all these things that they're talking about. They shine a whole new light on it, right? And they give me a different perspective. But I know these things, right? And it's just so amazing to hear somebody express what's in your heart. That is what we do, is one trunk talking to another, right? That's what we do. We identify with the problem and the hopelessness that we come in here with, and then we tell them, man, but you don't have to live there forever. You can live somewhere else, man. And then I thought about, oh, God. You know, then I immediately start comparing. It's like, these are speakers, right? I got to go give a talk after listening to these guys right here. Oh, man, this is... You know, and then I'm like, that's their truth. And they know how to say it well, yes, but you can go give them your truth, Dave. You can give them the best that you got, the true story of what is happening in your life. Man, I got a couple minutes real fast, and so I'm a grandfather. As of 2 years ago, I'm a grandfather. My son, God bless his heart, he moved to friggin' Dallas, right? Dallas, man. And I've made, since my grandson was born, I've made 5 trips out there to Dallas to see him, right? I'm like, I can't stay away. I can't stay away. This little boy is so darling. And now there's a 5-month-old baby girl, right? And it's like, we spent Halloween with them. We took them to their first Halloween trick-or-treating. And I'm like, I'm a grandpa. And I took my parents with me, right? So they got to see their great-grandson and their great-granddaughter. I'd have missed all of this. It had been a thing that might have been, right? Like the 24 years I was drinking and using, all that I could have contributed, all that I could have gave, all that I could have, my expression as a human being, as a child of God in this world was insulated for those 24 years. There was nothing flowing. And it's flowing now. It's flowing now. And it's because of rooms like this and people like you and the God of my understanding. So I'm going to thank you guys for letting me talk. I love you.
Thank you, Dave. On behalf of everybody here, I want to thank you for driving up and sharing your story for us. Let's give him one more hand, please.